Scene 1 of The Soul's Probation. The library and study of Capacius. Prevailing color, brown. An evening mood. First Capacius, then the spirit figures who are soul forces. Later, Benedictus. This scene and the following scenes of this play represent events which take place several years after the time of the portal of initiation. Capacius, reading from a book. By looking with the inner eye upon non-being, and dreaming in thought's shadow images with self-created rules, thus erring human nature wants to seek the meaning and the goal of life. From soul depths he would draw the answers to questions of the universe. Already, even at the outset, such musing brings to life delusions and sees at last its view of spirit consume itself, deprived of strength. He speaks. So Benedictus's noble spirit sight portrays with serious words the inner path of many human beings. To me each word hits heavy as a blow. With cruel truthfulness they show the path of my own life. And if a god in wildly raging storm should now descend on me in wrath, his fearful power could not torture me with more appalling terror than do these fateful words. In my long life I have but spun the images that move like shadow drawings within a dream of soul. And all this merely mirrors, as delusion, the world of nature and the spirit's action. Out of this ghostly web of dreaming, I've tried to solve the cosmic riddle. Down many a path I turned my restless soul impatiently. But now I recognize that, tricked, deluded, I did not live within my soul when threads of thought tried to expand themselves far out to cosmic reaches. Thus what I proudly pictured remained an empty image. Then came into my way Thomasius, the youthful painter. With genuine energy of soul, he was aspiring to the lofty attitude of spirit that changes human beings and frees from hidden depths the forces to create the springs of life. What rose out of his inmost grounds of soul reposes within every human being. And since it was revealed through him, I've understood. The greatest sin in life is to ignore the treasures of the spirit. I know now. I must search and not continue endlessly to doubt. In earlier years, my vanity of thought could have enticed me to the false belief that man aspires in vain to knowledge, and only resignation can be fitting for him who strives to find the springs of life. If I had had to recognize as height of wisdom that powers of human destiny demand I sink as individual being into the gulf of nothingness, I would have dared to do it unafraid. Today such thinking would be sacrilege, since I have learned so clearly that I should never rest until the spirit treasure in my soul has found the light of day. The fruits of spirit beings' work have been implanted in the human soul. The God's own work will be destroyed by those whose heedlessness lets seeds of spirit wither. I recognize what is the highest duty of my life. But if I dare to take one single step into that realm from which I cannot turn, I feel how just those forces leave me by which my vanity of thought once tried to throw some light on time and space and goals of life. Once I believed that it was easy to press the thoughts out of my brain and they would grasp realities. But now, in trying to behold the springs of life illumined by the light of truth, my thinking's instrument seems dull. I torture myself fruitlessly to form clear images of thought out of the earnest words of Benedictus, directing me upon the paths of spirit. Resumes his reading. Enter calmly into depths of soul, and let strong courage be your guide. Cast off your former ways of thought when you descend into yourself to guide yourself toward selfhood. As you extinguish self-engendered light, the Spirit's brightness will appear to you. Speaks again. It is as if my breath had stopped when I attempt to grasp the meaning of such words. Before I sense what I should think, anxiety and fright take hold of me. I have the feeling all the things which until now had filled my life were crashing down, and in their ruin they soon must crush me into nothingness. Alas, I read 100 times the words which follow now, and every time the darkness has broken in upon me with ever-deepening gloom. Reading again. Within your thinking, cosmic thoughts hold sway. Within your feeling, cosmic forces weave. Within your willing, cosmic beings work. Lose yourself in cosmic thoughts. Experience yourself through cosmic forces. Create yourself from beings of will. In worlds far reaches, do not end through thinking's play of dreams. Begin within expanded spirit spheres and end in depths of your own soul. You'll find the aims of gods when you can know in you yourself. Sinking into his thoughts, he is made faint by a vision, then comes to himself and speaks. What was this? 3 figures, as soul forces, hover around him. Luna. You do not lack the strength for lofty spirit flight. It's founded well upon the human will. It's hardened well by certainty of hope. It is well steeled by sight into the future. You only lack the courage to pour into your willing new confidence in life. Into the vast unknown, with courage, dare to venture forth. Astrid. From worlds afar, out of the joyful sunlight, from distant stars, out of the magic power of worlds, from azure, heavenly ether, out of the mighty spirit heights, strive for power of soul, and send its radiant beams deep down into your heart. Then knowledge will with warmth create itself in you. The other Philea. They are deceiving you, the wicked sisters. They wish to spin a web for you of fanciful tricks of life. The vain delusion of their gifts, which they are offering you, will vanish into air if you attempt to hold it fast with human force. They lead you on to worlds of gods, and will destroy you if you make bold within their realm to hold yourself as human being. The soul forces disappear. Capacious. It was quite clear. Being spoke here. Yet it is certain no one is here beside me in this room. Have I then spoken only to myself? That, too, seems quite impossible, for never could I have imagined what I think I heard. Am I still the one I was before? In his gestures, one can notice that he feels unable to answer yes. Oh, I am not. Spirit voice, the spiritual conscience. Your thoughts are now descending to depths of human life. What as soul enfolds you? What as spirit is bound to you, soars up to cosmic grounds, out of whose fullness, drinking, men live in thinking, out of whose fullness, living, men weave in seeming? Capacious. Too much. Too much. Where is Capacious? I implore you, unknown powers, where is Capacious? Where am I myself? Once more he is absorbed, brooding in himself. Benedictus enters unnoticed by Capacious, Benedictus touches him on the shoulder. It has come to my attention that you wish to speak to me, and so I've sought you out at home. Capesius, it is most kind of you to grant my wish, yet you could hardly find me in a worse position. That after so much pain which just has racked me, you do not find me paralyzed upon the ground before you, I owe to your kind glance alone that met my eye when gently you roused me from the horrors of my dream. Benedictus, it is not hidden from me that I find you in life's battle. I knew already long ago that we would meet some day like this. Prepare to change the sense of many words, that we can fully understand each other. And do not marvel if in my way of speaking your suffering must change its name. I find you in good fortune. Capesius, then you increase my pain, which throws me to darknesses. My very self, it seemed, had fled to cosmic depths, and through the sheaths strange beings had spoken in this room. That I saw through such spirit trickery as mere illusion, and that soul deception provided so much pain, only this could help sustain me. Oh, do not rob me of such feelings, firm support. Do not call this good fortune. It is to me but feverish illusion, or else I shall be lost indeed. Benedictus. In truth, a man can only lose what severs him from cosmic being. And if it seems to him that he has lost what in his thinking's dreamlike mood he has abused in worthless effort, then let him search for what has gone from him. If he can rediscover it, he may at last be able to dedicate it rightfully to man's endeavors. To try to comfort you in such an hour would only be a play on words. Capesius, no, teachings which would satisfy mere reasoning will never come from you. I've had to realize this bitterly. As actions sometimes lead us up to heights, but also hurl us down into abysses, your words pour streams of fiery life and also deadly chill into men's souls with mighty power. They have the same effect as blows of destiny or as the storms of love in life. Much had I thought and searched before we met, but I have learned to know creative forces of the spirit, as well as its destructive power, only since I've followed in your steps. The havoc that your words caused in my soul you could perceive on entering my room just now. I've often been tormented when meditating on the content of your book. Today, however, painful sorrow filled my cup, and my distress of soul flowed over while reading in your book those words of destiny. To understand their meaning was not yet granted me, but they gushed forth into my heart like springs of life, arousing world enchantment. This robbed me of my clarity of mind, and ghost-like beings were surrounding me. Significant, dark words I heard, resounding from erratic sickliness. I know that you do not confide to writing all that you must hold safe for souls of men, and that you only grant a riddle's answer to each according to his need. So grant me what I sorely need, for I must know what robbed me of my reason and my senses, as it surrounded me with an ephemeral magic spell. Benedictus, I do not wish my words alone to say what they convey as covering for concepts. They turn the natural forces of the soul to the realities of spirit. Their meaning is first reached when they unlock the power of seeing in souls surrendered to their force. They do not spring from my research, but are entrusted to me by those spirits who read the signs by which world karma manifests itself. It is the nature of these words to lead to founts of knowledge. Yet it remains with him who hears them in their own true sense to drink the spirit water at the source. It is not counter to the purpose of my words to lift you into worlds which must to you seem ghostly. You've entered now a realm which will remain illusion as long as you can lose yourself in it. However, if you here sustain yourself, this realm will surely open its first portal of highest wisdom to your soul. Capacious, and how can I sustain myself? Benedictus, the answer to this riddle you'll be granted if you can face with an awakened eye of soul the many wondrous things which soon will come your way. Ordained, I see you now to a probation by spirit forces and powers of destiny. He exits. Capacious, although the meaning of his words I can't explain, I feel them working actively within me. He's allotted me a goal, and I am ready to obey. He does not ask for striving in mere thoughts. He wants me to direct my steps into realities of spirit searchingly. I do not know the nature of his mission, and yet his action here compels my trust. He's brought me to myself again. So may the magic spell which frightened me at present still remain unsolved. And openly and freely I will face those future happenings which he has promised. Curtain, while Capacious remains standing, the end of scene 1. Scene 2 of The Soul's Probation. A meditation room, prevailing color, violet. Serious but not gloomy atmosphere. Benedictus and Maria, later spirit figures that represent soul forces. Maria, grave inner battles urge me in this hour to turn to you for guidance and wise counsel. Dark premonition rises in my heart, and I'm unable to oppose the thoughts that storm upon me constantly. They strike me in my being's deepest core. They want to lay upon me a command which to obey would seem like sacrilege. Deceptive powers are trying to beguile me. I beg you, help that I can banish them. Benedictus, you never need forego what you must ask of me. Maria, I know how closely to my soul are linked Johannes's paths of life. A thorny road of destiny united us, and in high spirit realms our bond was consecrated by the will of gods. All this presents itself to me as clearly as only images of truth can do, and I feel horror taking hold of me when I am forced to utter such a sacrilegious word, and yet deep in my soul I hear a voice which says distinctly, repeating, despite my will to fight it down, you must give up Johannes, let him go. You cannot keep him at your side if you would not do harm to him. Alone he must pursue the path which leads him onward to his goal. I know if you but speak one word, delusion's web will cease to haunt my soul. Benedictus, Maria, noble grief leads you astray. You see the truth in image of illusion. Maria, it could be truth. It cannot be. Between your guiding words and my own hearing, delusion also creeps. Oh, speak to me again. Benedictus, you've understood me rightly. Your love is noble, and Johannes was closely linked to you. But love should not forget that she is wisdom's sister. Johannes was united long indeed with you for his own good, and yet his soul demands that he pursue his aims upon his further path in freedom. The will of destiny does not decree that you should break your outer bond of friendship, but this it does demand, severely, Johannes's freedom in the spirit realm. Maria, I hear what must be still delusion. Allow me to speak further until you understand me. No spectral shape will dare so near your ears to twist these words. All doubts were easily dispersed if only earth life's tangled path had bound Johannes' soul to mine. But consecration was bestowed upon our bond, uniting soul with soul eternally. And spirit powers gave their benediction by speaking words which banish every doubt. He conquered for himself the truth in realms eternal, because in worlds of sense his inmost self had joined itself with you. How can I understand this revelation, if now its very opposite is true? Benedictus, you must find out how much indeed is lacking toward maturity, and even those to whom already much has been revealed. The paths of higher wisdom are entangled, and only those will find their way aright who walk in patience through the labyrinths. You could but see one part of full reality in realms of everlasting light, when to your eyes of soul appeared an image of the spirit land. This image is not yet complete reality. Johannes' soul and yours have been united by such earthly bonds as make it possible for each of you to find the way into the spirit realm by means of forces that you owe each other. So far, however, it has not been shown that you have both fulfilled all the demands. You were allowed to see a picture of what the future holds in store for you if you can stand the full ordeal. That you've been shown the fruits of striving does not yet prove that you have reached the goal of all your efforts. You have beheld a picture. Your power of will alone, however, is able to transform it to reality. Maria, although your words affect me like bitter grief that follows after joy, there is at least one lesson I have learned: to yield myself to wisdom's light when it becomes alive through inner force. Already something is becoming clear that lay in darkness for my heart till now. Yet, when in times of highest bliss delusion presses in upon the mind in the deceptive mask of truth, a darkness of the soul is difficult to ban. I need still more than you have given if I'm to grasp the meaning of your words. You've led myself to depths of soul where light was granted me, to look into those lives on earth which were allotted me in times long past. I could experience how Johannes' soul and mine had found each other, that I could bring his soul so long ago to the pure spirit word. I could consider this to be the seed which, growing, could become the fruit of friendship, to be found ripe for all eternity. Benedictus, you were accounted worthy to retrace the earthly paths allotted you in days long past, but you should not forget to ask yourself if you are also certain not any of your paths of life conceals itself from you when backward you direct your spirit eye. Maria, after a pause which indicates deep self-reflection, how could I have been so blind? The blissfulness I felt when I could see a part of bygone times made me forget then, with false vanity, how much is lacking still. And only now it dawns on me that I must pierce through darknesses, if I would find the way from present days to days of old, when my friend's soul inclined itself toward mine. To you, my guide, I'll make my vow to tame my soul's proud arrogance. Right now I recognize how vanity of knowing can deceive the soul. Instead of gaining strength from freely offered spirit treasures, it uses them for wanton mirroring of self. And at this very moment, my heart's forewarning voice, encouraged by the power of your words, has told me I must feel how far I am from reaching still the nearest goals. No more will I too hastily interpret the knowledge granted me from spirit lands. I will esteem it as a force which helps to shape my soul, not as persuasion which spares me efforts of my own to recognize the life goals of my actions. If I had only heeded sooner this word, which asks humility of me, the truth could not have been obscured. My friend's so richly gifted soul can only grow and then unfold in freedom when he can find such paths as are not drawn by me beforehand. And now that this is clear to me, I shall not fail to gain the strength to do what love and duty ask. Yet in this hour I feel more deeply than I have ever felt before a hard probation of my soul draws near. When men must tear out their hearts, what of the loved ones lives in them? Love has been changed into its opposite. They of themselves change what unites them, because they gather strength from passion's urge. But now of my free will must I abolish the influence which my soul life had on the actions of my friend, and yet my love must still remain unchanged. Benedictus, you'll find your way if you will recognize what you most valued in this love of yours. For if you know which force leads you unconsciously within your soul, you'll find the power to do what duty must require of you. Maria, in saying this, you've given me the help of which my soul is in such need. Within my being's inmost depths, this weighty question I must ask: what in this love is urging me so strongly? I see my separate soul life working within Johannes's being and within his art, and thus what I am searching for is satisfaction, which I can feel in my own self and live in the delusion that I'm selfless. It has remained concealed to me that in my friend I mirrored but myself. It was the dragon self-conceit that veiled deceptively from me what was in truth impelling me. For self-conceit transforms itself 100-fold. I recognize it now. And when one thinks it overcome, it only rises with much greater force out of the ruins of its former tyranny. Moreover, it will gain more strength in showing the illusion deceptively in mask of truth. Maria sinks into concentrated thought. Exit Benedictus. The three figures of the soul forces appear. Maria. You, my sisters, I find when in the depths of being my soul, expanding, guides itself into the reaches of the universe. Release for me the powers of seeing out of etheric heights, and lead them down to earthly paths so that I may explore and find myself in course of time and give direction to myself to change old ways of life into new spheres of will. Philea, I will imbue myself with striving light of soul out of the heart's own depths. I will breathe in enlivening power of will out of the Spirit's urging, that you, beloved sister, within old spheres of life may feel and sense the light. Astrid, I will weave into one a selfhood's feeling of itself with love's forbearing will. I will release the burgeoning powers of will from fetters of desire, transform your languid yearning to certainty of spirit sensing, that you, beloved sister, on paths of earth far distant, explore and find yourself. Luna, I will call forth renouncing strength of heart, and will confirm enduring soul repose. These shall unite and raise empowering spirit light out of the depths of soul. They shall pervade each other, and shall subdue far distances of earth to the listening spirit ear, that you, beloved sister, in time's wide ranges may find the traces of your life. Maria, following a pause. When I can tear myself away from the bewildering sense of self, and give myself to you so that you reflect to me my soul from worldwide distances. Then I can free myself out of this sphere of life and can explore and find myself in other states of being. A long pause, then the following. In you, my sisters, I see spirit beings that quicken souls out of the cosmos's life. You bring to full maturity in man himself the forces germinating in eternities. Through portals of my soul, I often could find my way into your realm and could behold with inner eyes the archetypes of earth existence. I now must ask your help. It has become my duty to find the way that leads from present life on earth to long past ages of mankind. Release my soul life from its sense of self in time-enclosed existence. Open for me the sphere of duty brought from my life journey in ancient days. Spirit voice, the spiritual conscience. Her thoughts are searching in traces left by time. What remains for her as debt? What is bestowed on her as duty? Arise out of those soul foundations from whose deeps men guide their life, dreaming, in whose deeps men lose themselves, erring. Curtain, while everyone is still on stage, the end of scene two. This is scene three from The Soul's Probation. A room in rose red, cheerful atmosphere. Johannes at an easel. Marie enters later. Then spirit figures as soul forces. Johannes. Maria remained silent when last she saw my painting. Before, she always gave me rich treasures of her wisdom to aid the progress of my work. As little as I trust myself to judge whether my art fulfills the inspiration that flows out of our spirit teaching, so much I put my trust in her. And ever and again I hear the words in spirit, which strength bestowing brought me joy when first I dared to start this picture. Begin to paint, she said, in such a way that you, with courage, venture to show to earthly senses what spiritually the soul alone beholds. You will not fail to see how forms resembling thoughts can conquer matter, and how the shades of color akin to feelings enwarm the force of life. Thus, with your skill, you also may portray the higher realms. I feel the power of these words, and humbly yield to the belief that I draw near the goal that Benedictus has appointed me. Often I sat discouraged at my painting. Presumptuous it often seemed to me, at other times almost impossible, to represent in color and in form what I am granted to behold. How can the weaving life of spirit, so far removed from earthly sense and to the seer's eyes alone unlocked, reveal itself by means belonging to the world of sense? This I have often asked myself. Yet when I set aside the personal, and following spirit teaching can feel myself removed in blissfulness to cosmic powers of creation, the firm belief in such an art awakens that is as true as is the science of the spirit. I learn to live within the light, to recognize the deeds of light as color, just as the student of this science sees spirit deeds and soul realities in realms of life devoid of form and color. Relying on this spirit light, I gained ability to feel as one with flowing seas of light, to live with color's streaming glow, and to divine the spirit powers holding sway in weaving light, released from matter, in living color, filled with spirit. Maria enters, unobserved by Johannes. And when my courage fails me, I think of you, my generous friend, and your soul's fire has warmed my urge to work creatively. Within your spirit light is wakened in me the power of faith. He sees Maria. Oh, you are here. Impatiently I've waited, and then could miss your coming. Maria, I must rejoice to see you so absorbed in your own work that you forget your friend. Johannes, oh, you should not say that. You know that I myself cannot create one picture that is not blessed by you. There is no work of mine that does not owe its origin to you. You've purified me in a fire of love to make me capable of shaping through my art what shows itself to you in shining glory. This shining, warming, life-transforming glory reveals in radiance the spirit world. And I must sense how my creative flow streams forth from your soul's fountain into mine. Then I can feel the wings that lift me to heights of spirit far from earth. I love what lives within your soul, and loving can bestow upon it image form. This love alone produces forces in the artist, which fruitfully live on in all his work. If as an artist I should carry pictures from spirit realms into the world of sense, the cosmic spirit must appear through me, and my own person only be its instrument. First, I must break the bonds of selfishness that I do not portray, instead of spirit realms, my own delusions, fantasies. Maria, and if you would receive out of yourself, and not through me, the primal source of your creation, the beauty of your paintings would appear more unified, from regions of one soul. Johannes, I would be spinning webs of idle thought were I to speculate on what for me is best, whether to embody your spirit vision in my art, or whether I should seek the origin of images within myself. I know I could not find them in this way. I can dive down into soul grounds and find myself with bliss in spirit worlds, and I can lose myself in realms of sense, pursuing with my eyes the miracles of color that to my sight reveal creation's deeds. Yet, left alone, whatever I experience within my soul must lead a life devoid of all creative urge. But if I follow you to cosmic heights, and re-experience in blissful warmth what you have seen already in the spirit, within that vision I can feel a fire whose flames burn on within me, and thus flaming enkindle powers forcing me to work creatively. If I were to express in words to others what I can bring to clear cognition within the higher worlds, then I could lift myself to spheres where spirit speaks to spirit. An artist has to find that fire which, radiating from his work, burns on in human hearts. And I can only pour into the picture what streams as magic spirit fervor into hearts if first my soul can drink from your heart's depths the spirit revelation. How primal powers condense themselves in longing, and how creation's forces strike sparks in spirit action, and how, divining man in need of being, they soon create themselves as gods in time's beginning. Of this, my friend, so often spoke in lofty words so that the unseen I might grasp. Then, in the gentle ether red of spirit worlds, I tried to densify what is invisible by sensing how the colors nurse a longing to see themselves in souls, transfigured into spirit. So speaks the inmost being of my friend, as does my own to human hearts out of my pictures. Maria, consider well, Johannes, that an entity of soul, severed from others, has to unfold itself from world beginning as a single being. Love that unites the severed beings will not destroy their selfhood's life. The moment has arrived for us when we must test our souls in how to guide their further steps on spirit paths for each one's separate good. Exit Maria. Johannes, what did my friend just say? I cannot understand her words. Maria, let me follow you. The three figures of soul forces appear. Luna, you cannot find yourself within the mirror of another soul. The force of your own being must root itself in cosmic ground. if from the heights of spirit it would implant their beauty in depths of earth in its true form. Be bold enough to be yourself, that you may offer up that self as valiant shape of soul to cosmic powers. Astrid, you must not lose yourself upon your cosmic paths. Men do not reach far distant suns by robbing their own being from themselves. Prepare yourself, transcending human love, to penetrate to inmost depths of heart, where cosmic love will ripen. The other Philea. Oh, do not listen to the sisters. They lead you into cosmic reaches and rob you of earth nearness. They do not see how earthly love bears all the traits of cosmic love. Their beings rule in coldness. Their forces flee from warmth. They want to lure each man out of his depths of soul to freezing worlds on high. Curtain falls, with Johannes, Luna, Astrid, the other Philea standing quietly. The end of scene 3. Scene 4 of The Soul's Probation. The same room as in scene 1, Capacius and Strader. Capacius to Strader, who has just entered. A hearty welcome, friend, to you who used to stand up valiantly against me in our heated arguments. It has been too long since you last visited my house. You used to like to come more often. Strader. I've had so little time. My life has changed immensely. No longer am I torturing my brain with specters of despairing thoughts. I dedicate the knowledge I have won to honest work that will in some way be of use in life. Capacius. Then you have left your line of research? Strader. You could say, too, that it's left me. Capacius. What goals have you now set yourself? Strader. Our life is far from able to point out goals that men can clearly understand. It is a treadmill, a mere engine that pins us by its whirring wheels and hurls us wearied into darkness when the measure of our strength is spent. Capacius. I've known you when you dared to grapple courageously with all the riddles of existence. I've also seen how you experienced your hard-won knowledge slipping away from you into the void, and deeply shaken, you, as searcher, had to drink the bitter cup of disappointed dreams. Yet I could not conceive you would be able to tear out of your heart the urge that filled you so completely. Strader. Do you remember still the day on which a seeress, through the truth of what she said, made clear to me the error of my path? I had no choice but to acknowledge then that all our toil of thinking can never find the fountainhead of life. For what we think must be indeed mistaken, when to the force of soul this woman called her own, the light of highest wisdom is revealed. I'm certain that stern science would aim in vain at such a revelation. If there had been this one defeat of my conceited searching, I think I could have made a new beginning and joined my path to all those other ones. But seeing how this strange approach to spirit, which seemed to me at times sheer madness, could change mere impotence into creative force, then all my hope was lost. Do you remember the young painter we met together upon those doubtful spirit paths? After such blows of fate, I lived for many weeks benumbed and near to madness. As nature brought me back to sanity, I formed the firm decision to stop all further searching. I needed time to gain once more my health in mind and body. I've passed it joylessly. I made myself proficient in those things which lead to practical accomplishments. Today I supervise a shop which manufactures screws, and thanks to this activity I can, for many hours, forget how torturing my worthless struggle was. Capacius, I must confess that I can hardly recognize the former friend in him who stands before me now. Besides those hours of which you spoke, do you not also live through times in which old tempests are renewed, which force you out of that dull mood? Strada. The hours are not withheld from me when weakness fights with weakness in my soul. But destiny withholds from me in this completely wasted life new rays of hope to penetrate my heart. Renunciation will I conquer for myself. The strength which it demands may give me the ability to follow in another way the path of research, if perhaps my life on earth repeats itself. Capasius, you spoke, did I hear you rightly, of repetition of your life on earth? So have you then attained that crucial truth upon those spirit paths which even now you still esteem as dubious? Strada. So now you've found the third essential cause that strengthened my resolve to make a new start in my life. There, on my sickbed, I surveyed once more, before I turned to other goals, the sum of knowledge I'd acquired. 100 times I asked myself, what can our natural science teach us, as we can summarize it all today? There is no way around it. The repetition of our life on earth, our thinking neither can nor dare deny it, unless we break with everything that steady research has discovered throughout the course of time. Capasius, could I have had such an experience, it would have spared me bitter pain. For many sleepless nights I have passed, and longed that thoughts like these might bring relief and liberation. Strada. And yet this spirit flash has robbed me of my remaining powers. I always felt it as strongest urging of my soul to test through life itself what thinking gave to me as truth. It seemed a chance desire to prove by my own life in all those days of anguish how cruel and influential is this truth. It makes life's joys and sorrows seem to be the consequences of what we really are, and this indeed is often hard to bear. Capasius. This seems impossible to me. What can transcend a truth for which we search unceasingly and which can give us spirit certainty? Strada, that may be so for you, but I feel otherwise. You know my life's strange course? It seemed but chance that crossed my parents' hope for me. They wished me to become a monk. They've often said that they took on their son's apostasy as the great sorrow of their life. I bore all this, much more, indeed, besides, as one is prone to bear one's life when birth and death become the limits of our earthly pilgrimage. Also my later life, with all its crumbled hopes, appeared to me so shaped that it could only through itself be understood. Oh, had the moment never come that brought me to a different opinion. For you must know, I've not related all that destiny has put upon me. I am not the child of those who wished me to become a monk. They had adopted me when I was but a few days old. I was a stranger even in my boyhood home. My actual parents are unknown to me. Estranged have I remained to all that has gone on around me in my later life. My thinking now requires of me that I look back to former times, when I deprived myself of contact with the world. Indeed, this thought must follow thought. Whoever has become a stranger in the world before his consciousness has dawned in him, has truly willed this destiny before his will was guided by his thought. Because I have remained just what I was at first, all doubts in me have vanished. With apathy I must succumb to powers that spin my threads of destiny and will not show themselves to me. What more of cruel proof is left to show how dense the veils are that conceal my inmost being from myself? Now judge without false thirst for knowledge. Has this new truth brought any light to me? It gave me certainty, indeed, that in uncertainty I must remain. It showed to me my destiny, half filled with sorrow and half with irony. I could repay in the same coin. It overwhelmed me. Tortured by bitter scorn, I had to face my life, and scoffing at the magic trickery of fate, I yielded to the darkness. Yet there remained one single thought. Enmesh me, life, in your machinery. I am not curious what makes your cogwheels work.
Capacius.
The man that I have known in you could not remain for long in such a barrenness of thinking, even if he wished. Already I can see the day's approach when, changed, we'll find each other once again.
Curtain falls while the two are still facing each other. End of scene 4.
Scene 5 of The Soul's Probation. A landscape with Balda's lonely cottage. Mood of evening. Felicia Balda, Capacius, then Felix Balda, later Johannes and his double, then Lucifer and Arman.
Capacius enters and comes toward Felicia, who is sitting on a bench in front of her cottage.
May your old friend walk up and rest a little while with you. Now more than ever does he feel in need of what he's found so often at your house.
Felicia.
When I could see you coming in the distance, your weary steps foretold, and near at hand your eye reveals it too, that sorrow dwells within your soul today.
Capacius, sitting down.
To bring much gaiety into your home was never possible for me. Today I ask for special patience when, with a restless heart, I trespass on this peaceful spot.
Felicia.
You've been so gladly welcomed here at times when hardly anyone came near our house, and now, despite events that came between us, you have remained our friend, though many people now are looking up this lonely place of ours.
Capacius. Then is it true what I have heard, that our dear Felix, so taciturn till now, has in these days become a much sought-after man?
Felicia. Ah, yes, good Felix, used to shut us off from all the world. Now he is forced to talk to many people. His duty, this new life, appears to be to him. In former days he wanted to confide to his own inner self alone what woods and cliffs revealed to him of spirit deeds and nature's power. Besides, it seemed to no one else worth knowing.
How much the times indeed have changed! Right many people now listen greedily to what my Felix reveals to them about his knowledge, which in the past they found most foolish. And when my dearest husband...
Felix enters from the house.
For hours on end must talk. I really long for those old quiet days. At that time he had pointed out so earnestly that only in the silent heart the soul should bear the spirit gifts bestowed on it in grace from godly realms. He called him traitor to the spirit world, whoever would reveal it to a hearing that opened only to the world of sense.
Felix Balda.
Felicia finds it hard to reconcile herself to our completely altered life. She once complained about our loneliness, and now complains no less when many a day we have few hours to ourselves.
Capacius.
And what has moved you to receive and welcome people in your secluded home?
Felix.
Obediently I followed spirit guidance that speaks within my heart when it demanded of me silence. And just as faithful to its call to speak, I shall now yield myself. The being of humanity transforms itself as earth existence gradually moves on. We are standing at a turning point of time. Some part of spirit knowledge must be unlocked for every man who wills to open mind and heart to it. I know my kind of speech has little of the form that counts today. The spirit life, they say, must be expressed with strictly logical thought structure, and this is lacking in my speech. They claim that genuine science, which should be based on firm foundations, cannot regard me otherwise than as a visionary soul who seeks a solitary road to wisdom and knows no more of science than of art. But others find it well worthwhile to peer into the tangle of my words, discovering things from time to time that can be grasped by common sense. I am a man who artlessly lets stream into his heart each revelation that may come to him. I do not know a knowing without words. When I hold converse in my inmost heart, when I take heed of nature round about me, there lives in me a knowledge that does not search for words. Speech is as closely bound to it as is his body's form to earthly man. A knowing, which in such a way reveals itself from spirit worlds, can be of service also to men who do not understand it. So everyone's allowed to come to me who will attend to what I have to say. I know full well that curiosity and other poorer reasons bring some people here. Yet if in this time now on earth such people's souls are not yet stirred, the good has been implanted and will work on in them. Cupacius, I'd like to say to you quite frankly, for many years I have respected you, yet up to now the sense of your strange words is closed to me as well. Felix, it will unlock itself to you most certainly. You strive with noble heart and spirit. The time will come when you will hear the voice of truth. Just look what rich endowments man has as image of the kingdoms of the worlds. His head, it is the heaven's mirror image, and through his limbs work spirits of the spheres. Within his breast the beings of the earth are moving, and stemmed against them all, there wrestle mightily the demons of the province of the moon, who have to cross the spirit being's aims. What as a human being stands before us? What as a soul we take in livingly? What as a spirit shines upon us, has been envisioned by the gods from all eternity? Their purpose was to bring together the forces out of all the worlds, which thus united shape the human form. Capacius, I'm almost frightened by this word, which boldly would consider the human being the achievement of the gods. Felix, yes, therefore high humility is needed by him who would attain to spirit knowledge. For him who strives to know himself in arrogance and vanity, the gates of wisdom do not open. Felix returns to the house. Capacius, now help me, dear Felicia, as so often you've done before, so that my soul may turn itself to pictures and is able, and warmed by living images, to grasp these words as rightly they should be. Felicia, my Felix has repeated frequently to me the words he spoke just now, and they released out of my heart a picture, which I've often told myself I should relate to you. Capacius, do so, dear friend. I long for the refreshment that flows out of your picture treasury. Felicia, so be it. Once upon a time there was a boy who lived, the only child of a poor forester, within a woodland solitude. He knew, besides his parents, hardly any other people. His build was slender, his skin almost transparent. One could look long into his eyes. They treasured deepest spirit wonders. And though indeed few people entered the circle of his life, he never was in need of friends. When in the nearby mountains the golden sunlight glowed and glimmered, the boy's rapt, musing eye drew forth the spirit gold into his soul, until his heart resembled the morning brightness of the sun. But when, through darkening clouds, the morning sun rays could not pierce, and dreariness hung over mountain heights, the boy's eye too grew dull, a mood of sadness filled his heart. The spirit weaving of his narrow world took hold of him so fully that it was no less strange to him than were his body and his limbs. The trees and flowers of the woods were all his friends. There spoke to him from crown and calyx and from the lofty treetops spirit beings, and what they whispered he could understand. Such wondrous things of worlds unknown unlocked themselves before the boy whenever his soul conversed with what most people would regard as lifeless. At evening, his anxious parents from time to time missed their beloved child. The boy was at a spot nearby where from the rocks a spring burst forth, and water drops, dispersing thousandfold, were scattered over stones. when moonlight's silver glance in sparkling colors sorcery was mirrored in the water's misty spray, the boy could sit for hours on end beside the rock-born spring. And figures, formed by spirit magic, arose before his youthful vision in rushing water and in moonlight's glimmer. They grew into three women's forms, who told him of those things toward which his soul's desire was turned. And when, upon a gentle summer night, the boy was sitting at the spring again, one woman of the three caught up a myriad of drops out of the glittering spray and gave them to the second woman. She fashioned from the tiny drops a chalice with a silver gleam and passed it to the third. She filled it with the moonlight's silver rays and gave it to the boy, who had beheld all this with youthful inner sight. Now, in the night which followed this event, he dreamed that he was robbed by a fierce dragon of the chalice. After this night, the boy beheld just three times more the wonder of the spring. Henceforth the women came no more, although the boy sat musing beside the rock-born spring in moonlight's silver sheen. And when 360 weeks had run their course, three times, the boy had long become a man and left his parents' home in forest country to live in a strange city. One evening, tired from the day's hard toil, he pondered on what life had still in store for him, when suddenly he felt himself a boy, caught up and carried to his rock-born spring. Again he could behold the water women, and this time heard them speak. The first one said to him, "Remember me at any time you feel alone in life. I lure man's eye of soul to starry spaces and ethereal realms. And whosoever wills to feel me, I offer him the draught of hope in life out of my wonder goblet." And then the second spoke, "Do not forget me at the times when courage in your life is threatened. I lead man's yearning heart to depths of soul and up to spirit heights. And whosoever seeks his strength from me, for him I forge the steel of faith in life, shaped by my wonder hammer." The third one could be heard, "To me lift up your eye of spirit when your life's riddles overwhelm you. I spin the threads of thought that lead through labyrinths of life and the abyss of soul. And whosoever harbors trust in me, for him I weave the living rays of love upon my wonder loom." Thus it befell the man, and in the night that followed this he dreamed a dream. A savage dragon prowled in circles round about him, and yet could not come near him. He was protected from that dragon by the beings he had seen beside the rock-born spring, and who with him had left his home for this far distant place. Capacius, warm thanks to you, dear friend. I leave you with rich blessings. He rises and walks away. Felicia enters the house. Capacius, at some distance, alone, speaks as follows. "I feel how such a picture works on within my soul, bestowing health. How, to my thinking, it is able to restore the forces I have lost. The story was so simple that she told, and yet it stirs in me the powers of thought that bear me into unknown worlds. In this fair solitude I will indulge in dreaming. This has so often endowed my soul with thoughts that proved far better than many fruits of endless brooding." He goes down a path between the bushes and disappears. Johannes appears in deep contemplation in the same part of the forest glade. "Was it a dream? Was it reality? I cannot bear what my friend said in gentle calmness, yet so firmly, about our separation. If I could only think that reasoning, antagonistic to the spirit, had set itself between us as a deceptive image. I cannot, will not follow the counsel that Maria gave to drown the voices in me that speaks, to drown the voice in me that speaks unceasingly. I love her, This love remains for me the only spring of action that I wish to know. What is all the creative urge to me? What is the outlook toward high spirit goals if they can rob me of the light illuminating my existence? Within this light I have to live. If it were taken from me, I'd wish for death through all eternity. I feel my strength is ebbing when I attempt to think. I'd have to follow paths no more illumined by her light. There weaves before my eyes a mist. It's shrouding in confusion the marvels which this forest and these rocks had painted gloriously before my eyes. A wild dream rises out of the abyss. Oh, terribly it shakes me through and through. Away from me! I thirst for solitude, for it will let me keep the dreams that are my own. In them I still may yearn for what seems lost to me. It will not leave me, so I must flee from it.
Feels himself fastened to the ground.
What chains are these that hold me fettered to the ground?
The double of Johannes Thomasius appears.
Alas! Whoever you may be, if human blood is flowing in your veins, or if alone as spirit you exist, leave me alone. Who are you? Has a demon thrust myself before myself? He will not go. It is the image of myself. Seems to be still stronger than is my being in itself.
The double.
Maria, I love you, near you, with beating heart. With feverish blood I am consumed. And when your eyes meet mine, hot waves pulse through me. And when you put your loving hand in mine, blissfulness pervades my limbs.
Johannes.
You phantom, woven out of vapor mist, you dare blaspheme the purest feelings of my heart? What weight of guilt is laid upon me that I must now perceive a lewd distortion of the love I look upon as holy?
The double.
I listened to your words. I seemed to swallow them into my soul as message from the land of spirits. But more than by such revelations I was impelled to love your nearness. And when you spoke of paths of soul, there streamed through me a rapture that surges turbulently in the blood.
The voice of conscience.
So speaks, revealing, not yet concealing, from shine receding, in blood proceeding, the secret fire, fanning desire.
The double, with somewhat altered voice.
I cannot forsake you. You'll find me often at your side. I will not leave you till you have found the strength to shape me to a likeness of the being that you will some day be, but are not yet. In the illusion of your narrow self alone, can you behold that likeness?
Lucifer and Ahriman appear.
Lucifer.
O man, conquer yourself. O man, redeem me. You have defeated me in your soul heights, but I stay bound to you in being's depths. You'll always find me upon your path of life when you attempt completely to shield yourself from me. O man, conquer yourself. O man, redeem me.
Ahriman.
O man, embolden yourself. O man, experience me. You've gained for yourself the seeing of spirit beings. I had to spoil for you the quickening of your heart. Often, indeed, you'll suffer the hardest agony of soul if you'll not bend yourself to powers of mine.
O man, embolden yourself. O man, experience me. Lucifer and Ahriman disappear, the double also.
Johannes goes further into the darkness of the forest in deep musing.
Capasius reappears.
From behind the thicket, he has followed the scene between Johannes and the double as in a vision.
Capasius.
Whatever came upon me? Like a depressing nightmare it weighs on me. Thomasius came this way. He seemed absorbed in quiet meditation. Then he stood still as if he spoke to someone, yet no one else was there. I felt as if dread fear were weighing down on me.
but then I saw no more of anything around, as if asleep, unconscious I seemed, to have been drawn into a world of pictures, which I can recollect quite well. It could have only been a short time then that I sat dreaming, lost to myself. How rich, however, was this world of dreams, and ever stranger does it seem to me. I could distinctly see the people of bygone days and hear them speak. About a spirit, brotherhood, I dreamed, which strove toward mankind's highest goals. Within their midst I clearly saw myself. I felt familiar with it all. A dream? And yet soul-stirring was the dream. I know that I could never have experienced the like of it within this present life. The after-feeling which remains with me pervades my soul as real life would do. An elemental power draws me to these pictures. Oh, could I but behold that dream again! Curtain falls, while Capasius remains standing. The end of Scene 5. Scene 6. Scenes 6, 7, 8, and 9 take place during the first third of the 14th century. A forest glade. In the background, a high cliff on which stands a castle. A summer evening. Peasants pass through the glade and speak as they pause along the way. First peasant.
See here, the wicked Jew. He will not dare to take the same path as we, for he might hear such things as burn his ears.
Second peasant. We should show him, for good and all, we shall no longer tolerate his boldness, sneaking across the border into our quiet homeland. First woman. He is protected by the lords, who live there in the castle. Not one of us is given entrance. The Jew they readily admit. He does whatever they would have him do.
Third peasant.
'Tis hard to know who's serving God, who's serving hell. We should be thankful to our knights. They give us bread as well as work. Where should we be without them?
Second woman.
Now, I must say a good word for the Jew. He freed me of my cruel sickness by his own remedies. He was so kind and good beside. He's done the same for many others, too.
Third woman.
A monk, however, has divulged to me that devilish are the means by which he heals. Be well on guard against his poison. 'Tis said to change within the body and offer entrance to all sins.
Fourth peasant.
The men who serve the knights combat our ancient customs. They say the Jew knows much that good and blessing brings, but will be rightly valued only in days to come.
Fifth peasant.
New and better times are soon in store. I can foresee them in the spirit, for pictures from the soul show things my body's eyes cannot behold. The knights are willing to bring all this about for us.
Fourth woman.
It's to the church we owe our loyalty. It saves our souls from devil pictures, from death and from the pangs of hell. The monks do warn us of the knights, of the sorcerer, the Jew.
Fifth woman.
We shall not bear this yoke much longer, imposed upon our patience by the knights. The castle will soon lie in ruins. A vision in a dream revealed all this to me.
Sixth woman.
The fear of heavy sin torments me. When I listen to the people say the knights are plotting to destroy us, I see but good in all that comes from them. I needs must call them Christian, too.
Sixth peasant. How men will think in days to come. Let us leave that to those who shall live after us. The knights are using us as tools to work their devil's arts, with which they fight what's truly Christian. When they are driven out, we shall be free of their control and live our lives as we shall choose, here in our native land. Let us now go to Vespers. We find there what our souls require and what's in keeping with the customs of our fathers. New teachings are not right for us. The peasants go out. Simon the Jew enters from the wood.
Simon. It always is the same old hate and scorn which I must hear from every side.
yet ever and again I'm filled with pain that I'm unable to defend myself. There seems to be no reason for the way I'm persecuted by the people. And yet one thought pursues me often that brings this truth before my soul, that meaning lies in all that we experience, and therefore, too, there's reason for what the people of my race must bear. And looking at the knights there in the castle, I find their destiny akin to mine. But purposely they took upon themselves what powers of nature have imposed on me. They set themselves apart from other men in lonely striving to develop forces by means of which they win their goals. I feel how much I owe my destiny for blessing me also with solitude. Depending on myself alone, I could devote myself to science. Its teachings made me realize our time is reaching toward new goals. There must reveal themselves to man such laws as nature, such laws of nature as till now were strange to him. He will soon conquer for himself the world of sense, and out of it will liberate the forces that he will make subservient to himself. As far as I am able, I have tried to foster in this way the art of healing. These efforts have endeared me to the knights. They have permitted me to study on their land the forces that reside within the plants and can be found within the soil, so that I learn the future ways of healing. I labor so according to their aims, and may confess that on my path I've gladly gathered some good fruit. He goes further into the wood. Thomas the Master Miner enters from the wood. The monk meets him. Thomas, I'll rest a little here. I need tranquillity so that my soul again recovers from the storms that have been breaking in upon me. The monk meets him. Monk, I greet you heartily, my son. You've come here seeking solitude. After hard work, you look for quiet peace to turn your mind toward spirit worlds. It pleases me to find my pupil in this mood. But why does sorrow cloud your eye? It seems that cares are burdening your soul. Thomas, pain is so often close to highest bliss. My life has shown me this today. Monk, have you encountered pain and bliss at once? Thomas, I have confided in you, Reverend Father, how much I love the overseer's daughter. She too has given me her heart, and as my wife shall share my life with me. Monk, she'll stand by you in joy and sorrow, a piously devoted daughter of the Church. Thomas, it's only such a wife I want, because from you, beloved teacher, I've learned submission to the will of God. Monk, and are you also sure of your own soul? Will it persist along the path which I could show you as the right one? Thomas, as truly as this heart beats in my body, so faithful shall your son forever be. Submissive will he be to that high teaching which from your lips he has received. Monk, and as you've told me of your bliss, now let me hear about your sorrow too. Thomas, I've told you often of my life. When I had hardly grown beyond my childhood, I started journeying from town to town. I often changed my place of work. There lived within my heart the constant wish to meet again my father, whom I loved, although I had not had much good from him. He had deserted my dear mother because, unhindered by a wife and children, he wished to gain a new life for himself. The craving for adventure lived in him. I was a child still when he left us. My sister was just born, a short time after my mother died of grief. My sister was looked after by good people who later left my native town. I have heard nothing further of her life. Some kinfolk helped me to learn mining, and I progressed so far in it, wherever I sought work, I always found it. The hope has never left me that I would find again my father. And now this hope, fulfilled at last, has gone from me forevermore. On an official matter, I reported to my superior yesterday. You know how I dislike the knight who is the supervisor of my work, since I discovered you oppose him.
From that time on I've been determined to serve no longer at the castle. But in our meeting, for some unknown reason, the knight could give our conversation a turn that made it possible for him to declare himself to be my father. What followed? Oh, I cannot bear to speak of it. I could have quite forgotten all the sorrow which he inflicted on my mother and myself when now at last I stood before my father, who, bowed by sorrow, spoke of bygone days. But in him your opponent stood before me. One thing alone was clear to me, the deep cleft that must sever me forever from him I wished so much to love, whom ardently so long I sought. I've lost him now a second time, and so I feel the suffering I've had. Monk, I never would estrange you from the bonds your blood ties lay upon you. And yet what I can offer to your soul indeed shall lovingly be given you. Curtain during their exit. End of scene 6. This is scene 7. A room within the castle, which in scene 6 was viewed from outside. It is decorated with symbols of a mystic brotherhood. First the knights are shown during a meeting, then the monk with one of the knights. Later there appear the spirit of Benedictus, who has died 50 years earlier, Lucifer and Armon. The Grand Master with four knights are gathered along a long table. Grand Master, you have become companions to me in search of mankind's future goals. We are directed by our order's precepts to bring these aims from spirit regions into the realm of earth activity. So loyally stand by me now within this hour of grave concern. Our venerable leader fell a victim to those powers of darkness which draw their strength from evil and yet promote the plan of wisdom by opposition's force. This plan seeks to convert the evil into good. But since our leader's death, our earthly strivings are in vain. Our enemies have overthrown already many a castle of our brotherhood. And fighting, many of our valiant brothers have followed the great master into the bright realms of eternity. For us, too, the hour is close at hand when these protecting walls must fall. Our enemies are spying out the means by which they can take hold of our possessions. These we've surely not acquired for profit, but as a means to gather round us people into whose souls we can implant seeds for the future. These seeds will ripen in their souls when out of spirit realms they find their way into a later life on earth. First Master of Ceremony. Our order must endure whatever dark design our destiny has yet in store. This one can understand. But that in perishing our whole community must sweep with it so many brothers' individual lives seems an injustice in the light of cosmic laws. My lips will not complain, for manfully our brothers died, but still my soul desires to understand the sacrifice required of a man united with a group when powers of destiny have doomed that group to its destruction. Grandmaster, the individual's separate life is linked most wisely with the cosmic plan. Among our brothers, one proves often able to serve our order with its spirit forces, although his life is not unblemished. His erring course of heart and mind will find atonement through the sufferings he has to bear in service to the whole. On him who bears no guilt from his own deeds, yet has to walk the thorny path marked out by karma for our order, pain will bestow new strength to raise himself to higher life. First Master of Ceremony. Then does our order tolerate within itself men also, lacking purity of soul, who consecrate themselves to its high goals? Grandmaster, the one who works devotedly for lofty aims, he weighs the good alone in souls of men, and he allows the bad to find atonement within the course of cosmic justice. I've summoned you, my brothers, in these our days of grief, in order to recall to you with earnest words that it behooves us joyfully to die,
for goals to which we pledged ourselves to dedicate our lives. In the truest sense you are my brothers. When in your souls resound courageously our orders, words of consecration, the separate life and being must be sacrificed by him who would set eyes on spirit goals, through sense-world revelation, who would, with courage, dare to pour into his individual will the spirit's power of will. First Preceptor, Most Worthy Master, if you would test the hearts of all our brothers, in clearest echo will resound to you those words of consecration. But we would hear from your own lips how to construe the fact that with our lands and lives the enemy robs us of souls as well, whom with our love we nurtured. For every day makes it more clear our people will surrender to the victors, not only through compulsion, but through the hate our foes have taught them against the spirit path which we have shown. Grandmaster, what we have planted in their souls, indeed, may for the present die. But those who breathed our spirit light will come again, and then bestow upon the world what we intended in our work. Thus to my spirit, from realms of death, our mighty leader often speaks, when I descend in hours of silence into my inner depths, and forces then awaken to hold me in the spirit land. I feel the presence of our leader then, and hear his words as often I have heard them in earthly life. He does not speak of our work's ending, but of fulfillment of our goals in later days on earth. The Grand Master and two knights go out, while two remain. First Preceptor, he speaks of spirit worlds in just the way that others speak of villages and towns. To me this manner is oppressive, in which our consecrated brothers talk of other regions of existence. Yet I am sternly bound to all our earthly aims. Second Master of Ceremony, I hold fast to our Master's words. The one who cannot hear with full belief the truth of spirit and of spirit worlds, he does not lack capacity to grasp such revelation. The things he lacks are of a different nature. If he does not feel worthy of belonging to the higher worlds, he can well sense it, but he would like to hide it from himself. The soul that has some hidden stains and must deceive itself about them can never yield itself to spirit knowledge. They go out. The monk appears in the same hall and is met by the second preceptor. Second preceptor, what brings you here into this house, which you consider enemy domain? Monk, I must include among my friends all those who bear the countenance of man. This is our stringent rule. Yet hostile may quite well appear to you what duty bound I am obliged to claim. I'm here at my superior's behest. They want, by peaceful means, the land restored to them, belonging to the church, by reason of old deeds. The piece of ground you made into a mine remains, in fact, our church's legal property. The way in which you have acquired the land can never be upheld before the law. Second Preceptor, whether by law we call it ours or not, the judges might dispute for a long time. It nonetheless belongs to us in light of higher justice. The piece of ground was undeveloped soil when it was purchased by our order. It was unknown to you that under it rich treasures lay concealed. We've won them by and for the work of men. Today these treasures travel to far distant places to further human progress, and many honest people work within the mine shafts of that ground, which when you held it was plain wilderness. Monk, then you do not consider it your duty that you prevail upon your order to reach a peaceful understanding with us and satisfy our rights? Second Preceptor, since we are not aware of any guilt, nay, more are certain of our rights, we'll calmly wait to see if you will feel obliged to add injustice to your cause. Monk, you must ascribe it to your stubborn will, if we are now compelled to other means. Second Preceptor, the honor of our order demands that only on the battlefield can it be robbed of its fair rights.
Monk. So then my mission is fulfilled, and we can save all further words. Would it be possible to see the master who gives orders here? Second Preceptor. He very likely will be at your service, but I must ask you, wait a little while. He cannot come at once. He goes out. Monk, alone. Oh, that my office forces me to enter the hall of this most hateful order. On every side my eye encounters these devilish designs and sinful images. An agonizing horror grips me. It's crackling. Oh, it's rumbling through the hall. I feel how evil powers want to encircle me. As I am not aware of any sin, I bid defiance to the adversaries. The horror grows. Oh! The spirit of Benedictus appears. All good spirits, stand by me now. Benedictus, take heed, my son. I could draw near you frequently when fervent prayer transported you to spirit worlds. So hear with courage also in this hour what you must bring to clear cognition, if spirit light in place of darkness should now hold sway within your soul. Monk, when I begged earnestly for clarity in moments of distress, and my devoted prayer was granted hearing in the spirit land, then you appeared to me, great master, who was the glory of our order in days you lived on earth. You spoke to me from higher realms, illumining my sense and strengthening my power. My soul's eye could behold you, my spirit ear could hear you. And now, devoutly in this hour, I listen to the revelation which flows from you into my soul. Benedictus, you find yourself within that order's house which you accuse of evil heresy. It seems to hate all that we love and to revere what we deem sin. Our brothers hold themselves obliged to hasten the downfall of this sin against the spirit. In this they are supported by words which formerly I spoke on earth. They do not dream these very words can only be renewed if they are nurtured for their further growth by those who are successors in my work. So let arise within your soul what I once thought in former days on earth, but now what it must be in view of a new age. The order here accepts its goals from occult heights. Look on it in that light, as I myself would do if I could walk among you actively within an earthly body. This order strives toward higher goals, and those who dedicate themselves to it divine already future times on earth. Their leaders see with a prophetic eye the fruits that ripen in a later age. Both science and men's way of life will change in form and aim. This order, whose persecution you support, now feels impelled to undertake the deeds which serve this change. And only when our brothers' aims unite for peaceful purposes with those the heretics pursue, can good in earthly progress blossom forth. Monk, the admonition you have found me worthy of, how can I follow it? It deviates most forcefully from all that in the past seemed right to me. Ahriman and Lucifer appear. What other beings now are drawing near? What wills them here and at your side? Ahriman, more counsel comes from other corners. You cannot deem it easy to obey your former master's warning. Just reflect that he is living in the realm of blessedness. What works toward law and duty there can only cause confusion for your present situation on the earth. Lift up your eyes into his heights when you seek comfort in the bliss which will be granted by world spirits to distant days on earth. But if at present you would act aright, be guided then alone by what your reason and your senses teach. You have succeeded well in fathoming these brothers' sin, which they must hide from all the world. It shows how their ideals can live quite well in sinful souls. Faced with a brother's sly designing, how can you care to live in peace with them? For error is a barren soil. It does not let the good fruit ripen. Lucifer, your pious mind and heart have shown to you the right direction.
The aims of every age transform themselves, but heretics should not lay out the future paths of men. The danger of this spirit order lies in its words that speak the truth. It may be given such a turn that makes the truth more dangerous than error. How foolish is the man who lives in the belief that when he shows his falsehood openly, all men will follow him as leader. The spirit knights are not so ill advised. Indeed, they speak about the immanence of Christ, because they know this name will open the portals leading to the souls of men. To capture for Christ's counter-image the hearts of men, you best must give this image the very name of Christ.
Monk. They sound confusingly. From worlds of soul those voices often heard, that always wished to fight what pious thought demands. How shall I find paths leading to the good if they are praised by powers of evil? It almost seems to me as if, no, may this word remain unthought. My leader, in his wisdom, will still guide me, so that the meaning of his words, now so obscure, will be disclosed to me.
Benedictus. I can direct you to the rightful path, if you will permeate yourself in deepest soul with words which formerly I spoke on earth. And if you then will search for those words' power of life within the worlds in which you can behold me now, the rightful path will be revealed to you.
The curtain falls while the monk, the spirit of Benedictus, Lucifer, and Ahriman are still present in the hall. End of scene 7.
This is scene 8.
The same room as the previous one. The first preceptor, Joseph Keane, then the Grand Master, with Simon, later the first and second masters of ceremony. Joseph Keane is the first to enter. The preceptor comes to meet him.
First preceptor.
You wish to speak with me? What is it that you have to say?
Joseph Keane.
Of import for yourself and me is what has caused my coming here. Thomas, you know, the master workman at the mines, he is in your employ.
First preceptor.
Well, I know the stalwart man, whose ingenuity we greatly value. He has endeared himself as well to all the workers under him.
Joseph Keane.
And Celia, my daughter, is also known to you?
First preceptor. Moved.
I've sometimes seen her when I met you and any of your people.
Joseph Keane.
It's so that we saw Thomas often in our home soon after he arrived. His visits then became more frequent. We saw that for our Celia there grew in him a deep affection. This certainly was not too strange to us, but all along we could not think that Celia would return his love. Her life was only spent in prayer. She ran away from people's company. But now it's more and more apparent that she's devoted to the stranger with all her heart. And as things stand, we find we're forced not to oppose our child's desire to give herself to Thomas as his wife.
First preceptor with uncertain gesture.
Why is this marriage, then, against your will?
Joseph Keane. My lord, you know I'm faithfully devoted to what this order stands for. With heavy heart, I know my daughter turns her love to those who charge both you and me with heresy. The monk, who is the head now of our neighboring cloister, and constantly combats this order's aims, has won outright our daughter's soul. As long as she remains within my house, I'd never give up hope that she might find the pathway back from spirit darkness into light. Yet I must give her up for lost, if she becomes the wife of him who seeks salvation, like herself, according to the teachings of the monk. And that one has succeeded in foisting upon Thomas his opinions as dogma that requires firm belief. With horror I have heard the curses which burst from Thomas's lips whenever there was talk about this order.
First preceptor,
we've many enemies. It means but little if one more is added to their number. Your words do not make clear what I can have to do with this.
Joseph Keane, my lord, you see this packet. These papers are reliable. My wife and I alone have read them up to now. Beside us, no one knows their content. But now it has to be entrusted to you as well. The girl who passes for our daughter
is not our child. We took her in our care when her own mother died. I think there is no need to tell you how all this came about. For long we did not know our foster daughter's father, and Celia still today knows nothing of her origin. She sees in us her own true parents. It could have always stayed the same, because the child is dear to us and like our own. But long years after Celia's mother died, these papers came to us. They make it clear who is our foster daughter's father. The preceptor shows his disquiet. I do not know if he is known to you. Oh, wait, this is still Joseph Keane talking, sorry. I do not know if he is known to you, but I am now quite certain that he is you yourself. I think there's not much more to say. But since this is your flesh and blood, I beg you for your help. Perhaps together we can try to save this girl from future darkness. First Preceptor. My worthy Keane, faithful you have always proved. I hope that I may count on you still further. There is no chance that anyone within these walls or on the outside might hear that I'm related to this girl. Joseph Keane. On this I pledge my word. I mean no harm. I only ask you for your help. First Preceptor. You'll understand at present I cannot answer you at once. I beg you, come to hear me out tomorrow. Joseph Keane. I will come. He goes out. First Preceptor alone. How grimly is my destiny fulfilled. I left my wife and children wretched because I felt them to be fetters. My vanity marked out for me the path which led into this spirit order. I pledged myself to deeds of human love with words which sound sublime. I've done this, burdened with a guilt that's rooted in the opposite of love. The wisdom of this order's guidance was present clearly in my case. The order placed me in its ranks and gave me its strict rules. I was compelled to gain insight into myself. On any other path in life, this knowledge might have been concealed from me. When, by a stroke of fate, my son came to this place, I thought that higher powers, in mercy, were showing me the way to expiate my sin. I have long known the foster child of Keane is my own daughter, whom I once forsook. The order faces its destruction, each brother resolute to meet his death in full awareness that our goals will further live for which he gives his life. For long now I have felt that I am unworthy of this selfless death, and so the resolution grew in me to let the Master know my situation and ask him to release me from the order. I wished to dedicate myself then to my children and bring about whatever of atonement is possible to me in this earth life. I see now clearly it was not the longing for his father led my son to me, though his good heart made him believe it. What guided him were forces of his blood which bind him to his sister. The other bonds of blood were loosened through his father's guilt. The monk would otherwise not have succeeded in robbing me completely of my son. He has succeeded well in this attempt, so that the sister too will be estranged from her own father. So nothing else remains for me to do but to ensure that they shall hear the truth about themselves, and then with resignation to await the penance laid upon me by those powers which keep account of our life's right and wrong. He goes out. After a pause, the Grand Master and Simon enter the room. Grand Master. You must now stay within the castle, Simon. Since they have spread the lying tale about the sorcery, each step you take outside would be most dangerous. Simon. In truth, it pains me bitterly to know that people, through their ignorance, can be so hostile to the help which only wants to serve their good. Grand Master. Whoever, through the grace of lofty spirit powers, can turn his gaze upon the souls of men, will see that there the adversaries oppose the soul's true being. The war our enemies prepare for us is but a picture of that mighty battle which ceaselessly one power in the heart must wage in enmity against the other. Simon. My noble lord, just now you spoke a word which strikes me in my deepest soul. Though I'm not born to be a dreamer, yet when I walk alone through wood and field, often before my soul appears an image, which I can no more master with my will than any object which my eye beholds. There stands before me then a human being who lovingly extends his hand to me, and in his features is revealed a pain which I have never seen on any face.
The greatness and the beauty of this man take hold of all the forces of my soul. I want to sink upon my knees and humbly submit myself to him, a herald out of other worlds. But all at once a violent rage flames up within my heart, and then I cannot check the urge in me which kindles opposition in my soul, and I must thrust away the hand so lovingly held out to me. As soon as I've regained once more my senses, the radiant figure has withdrawn itself. What then in contemplation I recall, what came before me often in the spirit, a thought stands forth before my soul which shakes me to the bottom of my heart. I feel persuaded by your teaching that speaks about a spirit being descended from the kingdom of the sun and in a human form appearing to the senses in order to be understood by human hearts. I cannot close myself to all the beauty which is inherent in your noble teaching. Yet I cannot yield my soul to it. I've had to recognize within this spirit being the primal form of man. Yet my own nature holds me back defiantly when I would turn to him in faith. And so I must experience within myself a war that is the prototype of outer strife. The riddle that torments and frightens me concerns my whole life's destiny. How shall I fathom that I understand you well, yet never can devote myself in faith to things your lofty revelation teaches? In loyalty I follow your example, and yet I feel my opposition to that example's origins and goals. When I thus come to know myself, all faith is drowned in doubt that I will ever find myself in this earth life. And often I am filled with fear and dread that these bewildering doubts may still persist through all my future earthly lives. Grand Master, the image you have seen, dear Simon, stood out before my spirit in full light, just as you planted it in vivid words. And while you spoke still further, the image changed and grew before my gaze, until I was allowed to see those things which link world goals with human destiny. The Grand Master and Simon exit. After a pause, the two masters of ceremony enter the hall. First Master of Ceremony. I must confess quite frankly, my dear brother, that the forbearance of our master seems to me incomprehensible when I must see the great injustice of our enemies. They do not want to know about our teachings, but paint them frighteningly to people as heresy and as the devil's work. Second Master of Ceremony. The Master's mild forbearance flows out of our teaching. Can we proclaim as highest goal in life the understanding of all human souls and yet misunderstand our foes? Among them, many follow Christ's example honestly. The deepest meaning of our teachings remains, however, sealed for those who hear them only with an outer ear. My brother, remember how reluctantly, with inner opposition, you grew willing to listen to the Spirit word. From what our masters have revealed, we know how, through the light of Spirit, future men will see the lofty being of the Son who lived but once within an earthly body. With joy we can believe the revelation, because we follow trustfully our leaders. But recently the man that we acknowledge our order's head spoke these important words. Your souls must gradually mature if you'd behold prophetically what will reveal itself to men in future. But do not think, he also said, that after your first soul probation this premonition will appear to you. For even when you have the certainty of men's return to life on earth, you'll have to face the second test, which will unloose your vanity of self, so that it spoils for you the spirit light. He also gave this solemn warning. In silent hours of your devotion, search how this delusion as soul fiend imperils the spirit-seeker's path. He who falls prey to it may see our human nature in those spheres where only spirit reveals itself to spirit life. Light. If you would worthily prepare yourselves to take in with your eye of soul the light of wisdom streaming from the Christ, you must keep careful watch upon yourselves that self-delusion may not blind you in moments when you think it far removed. By keeping these words well in mind,
will soon give up the false idea that we can easily today hand over the teachings that our souls profess. We must take comfort from the fact that we encounter many a soul who in our day unconsciously receives the seed for future lives on earth. This seed may seem at first in conflict with those powers to which in later times it will submit itself. Within that hatred which pursues us now, I can find only seeds of future love.
First Master of Ceremony, it's certain that the goal of highest truth can be revealed in words like these. Yet it seems hard already in these times to guide our lives according to their wisdom.
Second Master of Ceremony, here, too, I can accept our Master's words. It is not granted to all men to live earth's future in advance, but such men always must be found, who can foresee the shape of later days. They'll dedicate their heart to forces that can release existence from the present and guard it safely for eternity.
The curtain falls while the two Masters of Ceremony are still in the hall. The end of Scene 8.
This is Scene 9. A forest glade, as in Scene 6. Joseph Keene, Dame Keene, their daughter Bertha, afterward peasants, later the monk, finally Keene's foster daughter Celia, and Thomas.
Bertha, I'd like so much, dear mother, to hear from you that story, the one that Celia used to tell about. No one can tell us, as you, the tales which our dear father brings us from the knights. Indeed, there is surely no one who does not love to hear them.
Joseph Keene, these stories are true treasures for the soul. What they can give the spirit stays unchanged even beyond our death, and will bear fruit in later lives on earth. We marvel at their hidden truth, and out of marveling, our souls form knowledge, which we need in life. Yes, if only all the people understood what gifts the knights bestow on them. It is a pity Celia and Thomas at present have deaf ears for them, for they receive their wisdom somewhere else.
Bertha, today I'd like so much to hear the tale which speaks of good and evil.
Dame Keene,
right gladly I will tell it you. Now listen. Once upon a time there lived a man who pondered much about the world. His brain was tortured most of all by his desire to know the origin of evil. But he could give himself on this no answer. The whole world comes from God, so argued he. And God can only have the good within himself. Then how do evil men come from the good?
Time and again he pondered, all in vain. The answer could not be discovered. One day it came to pass this gloomy thinker upon his way beheld a tree, which was in conversation with an axe. And mark, the axe was saying to the tree, "What is impossible for you to do, that I can do. I can fell you, but not you, me." The tree then gave this answer to the haughty axe. A year ago, a man cut out the wood from which he made your handle out of my body with another axe. And when the man had heard this speech, a thought arose within his soul he could not clearly put in words. It gave, however, answer to his question, how evil can derive from good.
Joseph Keene, bear in mind this tale, my child, and you will see how we, in contemplating nature, arrive at knowledge in the human head. I know how much I can explain by pondering upon the tales by which our knights instruct us.
Bertha, truly, I am a simple little thing, and never surely could I understand what clever people would relate with learned words about their science. I have no sense at all for things like that. I get quite sleepy when our Thomas begins to tell us of his work. But when my father, coming from the castle, brings home the tales, and hour after hour puts his own thoughts to them, right gladly could I listen without end. Quite often Celia speaks about a pious heart,
which to her mind is something that I lack. But it is truly piety I feel when I call up these tales before my eyes and can, with all my heart, rejoice in them. Joseph Keene, Dame Keene, and Bertha go out. After a pause, peasants enter the glade. First peasant. My uncle came home yesterday. For long he's made an honest living as miner in Bohemia. Much news he has to tell of what he heard upon his journey. Great agitations everywhere. They're closing in upon the knights, and everywhere is well prepared against the brothers of the order here. The castle will soon be besieged. Second peasant. They should not hesitate too long. Full many of us will rush to join them in the fight, and you can count on me for sure among the first. First woman. It's headlong into ruin you'll be running. Who'd be a fool and not consider how well the castle has been fortified? In truth, there'll be a frightful war. Second woman. The peasants should not mix themselves in things they do not understand. But there are many busy ones going from place to place and stirring up revolt. Now it has come so far that helplessly the sick must lie untended in distress. The kindly man who formerly gave help to many a one no longer dares to leave the castle. They've harmed him dreadfully. Third woman. And that's because so many were embittered when they discovered whence the sickness came that's broken out among our cows. The Jew bedeviled them. He cures the people only as a sham to serve with hellish arts the evil powers. Third peasant. There was much gossip about heresy, which came to nothing. The people prospered, and no better could they do than pass their leisure time with evil talk. Then someone, shrewdly working on the people, made up the nonsense that the Jew bewitched our cattle. And then, of course, a storm broke loose. Fourth peasant. I think you should consider what war and all its horrors mean. Our fathers often told us what they endured in times when everywhere the land was occupied by troops. Fifth woman. I've said it time and again. Their lordship's rule must vanish. Indeed, a dream has shown to me how we can serve the troops and care for them right well when they arrive to carry out the siege. Sixth peasant. If dreams are still to be believed, we do not need to question. The knights have tried to make us more intelligent than were our fathers, and now they shall find out just how much cleverer we have become. Our fathers give them welcome here, but we will chase them out. I know the secret passageways which lead into the castle. I used to work up there until my anger drove me out. I'll show the noble knights how science can be useful. Fourth woman. He's surely planning nothing good. I feel quite frightened at his words. Fifth peasant. I have been shown already in a vision how soon by secret ways a traitor will lead the enemy into the castle. Sixth woman. I find such visions most pernicious. If we can think as Christians still, then we should know that honesty, not treachery, will rescue us from evil. Sixth peasant. I let these people talk and do what brings results. This one or that calls something wrong that he's not able to achieve himself because he lacks the courage. But let's go on our way. There comes the Holy Father on this path. He should not be disturbed. I always have been able to follow him so easily, but what he preached today, how much I could not understand. The peasants go out in the direction of the forest. After a pause, the monk enters along the path. Monk. The paths of soul must lead into confusion when man desires to follow his own being. It could be only weakness of my heart which brought before my eyes those phantoms I saw within the castle. They showed themselves in conflict. This proves to me how little yet in me the forces of my soul unite themselves. I will, therefore, bestir myself anew to kindle in myself those words which bring me light from spirit heights. Another path can lure the man whose mind stays blinded by his vanity. The soul can only triumph over falsehood by showing itself worthy of the grace
that can reveal from fonts of love the spirit light in wisdom's word. I know that I will find you, noble power. You will throw light on what the fathers taught, if, from the darkness of my self-conceit, with piously devoted heart, I can escape. The monk goes out. After a pause, Celia and Thomas come into the glade. Celia, dear brother, often ardently I bowed in silent prayer before the godly fountainhead, and longed wholeheartedly to be united with it. A sheen of light appeared then to my spirit, which radiated gentle warmth. It shaped itself into a human image, and looked at me with tender eyes, pronouncing words that sounded thus to me: You were forsaken once through man's delusion. You are supported now by human love. So wait till longing finds the path on which that love can guide itself to you. So spoke the human image to me often. I could not solve the riddle of these words. Yet dimly I divined with quickened feeling that one day they would be fulfilled. And then when you, beloved brother, came, and when I first set eyes on you, I felt my senses leaving me. You bore full likeness to that human face. Thomas, dream and prophetic feeling did not lie. It was my longing leading me to you. Celia, and when you wanted me in marriage, I thought you destined for me by the Spirit. Thomas, the Spirit wished to reunite us. Indeed, it's shown us this in perfect clarity, although at first we did not understand it. When we first met, it seemed to me as if the Spirit wished to give to me a wife, but I had found again the long-lost sister. Celia, and now there's nothing will divide us. Thomas, and yet there's much that stands between us. I must reject the brotherhood to which your parents link themselves. Celia, but they are filled with love and goodness. You will find in them the best of friends. Thomas, my faith will separate me from them. Celia, you'll find the way to them through me. Thomas, good Keen is of a stubborn mind. He will see naught but darkness there where I perceive the very font of light. This light of truth did not become accessible to me until maturer years. What I had learned of it in childhood was hardly conscious to my spirit. And later on it was my sole intent to work and get the scientific skill as means to earn a livelihood. Then, finally, I found the teacher and the guide who had the power to liberate my soul. The words he lets me listen to bear certainly the signs of truth. He speaks in such a way that heart and head alike can yield themselves to teachings he gives with gentle kindness. Till then I had to make the greatest effort to understand the other spirit path. I found this path must lead to error, relying only on those spirit forces which well may guide aright in earthly matters, but cannot lead to higher worlds. And how am I to find the way into the hearts of men who only expect salvation from this error? Celia, I hear your words, dear brother. They do not seem inspired by peace. Yet they recall before my soul from former days a peaceful image. It was on a Good Friday. Many years ago I saw the image I described before. The man who bore your countenance at that time spoke these words. Out of the Godhead rose the human soul. Dying, it can descend to depths of being. It will in time release from death the spirit. Not until afterwards was I aware that these words are the motto of our knights. Thomas, O sister, must I hear from your own lips the evil words our foes are treasuring as a revelation of the highest spirit truth? Celia, in my own heart I am indeed averse to all the outer doings of the knights. I'm faithful to the creed that comforts you, but I will always be convinced that those who, as the purpose of their teachings, avow such paths of soul, do follow in the steps of Christ. In my devotion to the Spirit, I must confess that I believe my brother's spirit wished to speak that day of inner goals for peace. Thomas, through powers of fate,
These inner goals for peace do not seem destined for our life. Our Father they have taken from us within the very hour that gave him back.
Celia.
Pain robs me of all clarity of sense when hearing how you speak about our Father. Your heart inclines you lovingly to him, and yet you tremble when you try to think yourself united with him once again in life. In loyalty you follow our wise teacher and cannot hear the message of true love that streams abundantly through all his words. I feel a dark enigma looms before me. I see your honest heart and your firm faith, and can but shuddering stand at the abyss which deepens dreadfully between them both. And if as comforter there did not live in me the hope that love will always overcome, I'd lack the courage to endure this grief.
Thomas.
It is concealed from you, dear sister, how power of thought can prove compelling once it has gripped the human soul. The Son does not oppose the Father here. Thought turns away from thought. I feel its force within my soul. To strive against it means in truth my own self's spirit death.
The curtain falls while Thomas and Celia are still in the glade. End of scene 9. This is scene 10.
The following is the continuation of the events which took place in the first 5 scenes. The same landscape as in scene 5. Capasius awakens from a vision which brought before his soul the pictures of his previous incarnation.
Capasius.
Oh, this strange countryside.
A bench, a cottage, and a glade before me. Do I know them?
They ask insistently for me to recognize them, yet they oppress me. They bear down as a heavy load upon me, though they seem real. No, all this is but an image woven of soul fabric. I know these images were formed out of the thirst and yearning of the soul. I have emerged, as if awaking from this yearning out of the widespread ocean of the spirit. Haunting and frightful rises from my soul depths the memory of all this longing. How searing was my thirst for worlds imbued with life. Delusions craving grew from want and burned, consuming my whole being. I wished tempestuously to be and live, and all existence wanted to escape me. A moment that now seems eternity poured storms of agony into my soul as only a full life can bring with it. Before this yearning's terror seized me, there rose what had created it for me. I felt myself expanded to the universe, bereft of my own being. But no, it was not I who felt this way. It was another being sprung from me. I could see men and deeds of men develop from cosmic thoughts, advancing throughout space, and pressing to reveal themselves as beings. Then they unfolded, one whole world of life before my eyes, in pictures, tangible. They took from my soul fabric the power to create existence out of thought. The more this world condensed itself before me, the less I could sustain the feeling of myself. And from the world of pictures, words resounded that thought themselves and stormed upon me. From life's deficiencies they fashioned beings and gave them strength from deeds of goodness. Out of the wide-flung space they sounded warningly, O man, know thou thyself within thy world. A being whom I saw confronting me showed me my soul to be his own. And then these cosmic words continued, as long as in the circle of your life you cannot feel this being closely interwoven, you are a dream that only dreams itself. I could not form clear thoughts, but I could see chaotic forces working and upsurging from nothingness to being, from being into nothingness. But when in spirit I strive further back, remembering what I could see before this chaos, there stands before my soul a picture of a life which is not so confused as all those things that I perceived in later moments, but which, in all its detail, showed me clearly men's lives and actions. Within this picture I would seem familiar with the people and with what they do. I recognize each soul I see. Their body shapes, however, are transformed. I look upon all this while feeling I could be myself a being of this world. It shows itself to me as real life, but leaves me cold, without emotion. It seems as if its working on my soul restrained itself until the later moment which earlier stood before my spirit. Amidst a spirit brotherhood, I could perceive myself and others too, but as a picture of those times long past that wrests itself from memory's deep wells. I can see the miner, Thomas, as my son, and then my thought must link him to the soul shown otherwise to me within Timotheus. The woman whom I know as Ceres now appears as my own child before my eyes. Maria, who befriends Timotheus, reveals herself clothed as a monk who fights our spirit brotherhood, and Strater bears the mane of Simon the Jew. In Joseph Keane and in his wife I see the souls of Felix and Felicia. I can survey quite clearly the lives of other people and my own, but while I am absorbed in them, they disappear out of my spirit view. I can perceive how the soul fabric that wove these pictures now pours itself into my soul, and I feel blissfulness is permeating my whole being. Freed, I seem, from sense's limitations. My being is expanded to the far reaches of the universe. Again, I feel that long, extended moment which I lived through before I was confronted with that picture of a life. Now I can look still further back. Condensing out of cosmic power of thought, there comes before my eyes the glade, the cottage, where Felicia and Felix so often comforted my sorrow. I find myself back on this earth, from which I was so far removed by earthly times and world's far reaches. But what unfeelingly I could behold before, the picture that revealed itself to me is settling like a heavy mist of soul in front of everything my senses now perceive. It's changing to a nightmare, the picture that so weighs on me. It's writhing in my soul depths. It opens cosmic portals, distances of space. What storms into my being's depths, what surges toward me from far reaches of the worlds? A voice as spirit conscience. Be aware of what you've seen. Be alive to what you've done. Renewed you are, reborn to being. Your life you have been dreaming. Rework it out of noble spirit light. Perceive the tasks of life with sight-empowered soul. But if you fail in this, to empty nothingness forever, are you bound? The curtain falls while Capasius is still present. End of scene 10. This is scene 11. A room for meditation as in scene 2. Maria, Ahriman. Ahriman. The web of thought you've been pursuing was spun with crafty care by Benedictus. It has indeed ensnared you in untruth. Timotheus and Capasius, too, are victims of the same deceptive vision. Their gaze, as well as yours, beheld that earthly life in days long past, and thereupon you wish to find, in just that time, the lives you lived before this present one. You will breed error out of error, only if you can let yourself determine as consequence of such imaginings the duties you aspire to on your earthly path. That Benedictus merely took the pictures out of your brain and set them in the past, you can discover clearly with what you know yourself. You saw the people of today with scarcely any change from those much earlier days. The women you beheld as women, men as men, their traits of character were similar as well. You cannot, therefore, any longer doubt that in your spirit vision you transformed your soul's delusion, not the truth, into those days of long ago. Maria, I see in you the father of deceit, but yet I know you often speak the truth. Whoever would reject each word of counsel he can receive through what you have to say would fall a victim to severest error. Just as illusion wears the mask of truth in order to ensnare men's souls with certainty, so can one also yield to such illusion by always trying, like a coward, to sneak past each place where error has its source. Man does not owe to you delusion only. From out the spirit of deceit there springs a power as well, which gives men judgment, clear and vigorous. Therefore in freedom I oppose you face to face. You have attacked that portion of my soul that must sustain itself in wakeful vigilance, in weighing all the evidence which you present to me in clever calculation. It might well seem that only pictures from my brain have been transferred to former days on earth. But now I ask you whether your own wisdom is able to unlock the portal to every epoch of the earth. Ahriman. No beings live in any spirit realm who would be hostile to my need for entrance into any epoch of the earth. Maria. The lofty powers of destiny have wisely appointed you to be their adversary. You further everything you wish to hinder. You bring the power of freedom to men's souls when you can penetrate their very depths. From you springs forth the power of thought, the origin indeed of phantoms in men's knowing, but it is guide as well to all men's sense of truth. There is one region only in the spirit realm in which there can be forged the sword before whose sight you have to disappear. It is the realm in which the souls of men form knowledge out of powers of reasoning and then transform it into spirit wisdom. If at this moment I forge rightly the word of truth into that sword, you will be forced to leave this place. So hearken, you who are the father of deceit, if what I speak before you is triumphant truth. There are such times in earthly evolution when gradually old forces pass away, and, dying, see the growth of newer ones. At such a turning point of time, my friends and I could find ourselves together in the spirit, while they were seeking out their life on earth. True spirit men were active at that time, united in a brotherhood of souls, which took its aims from occult heights. At such a turning point of time must seeds that need much time for full maturing be planted carefully in human souls. Such men will show in their next life on earth still traits of character out of an earlier one. There will be many men at such a time, reborn as men in their succeeding life, and many women reappear as women. The interval is also shorter than that usually between two earthly lives. To understand such turning points of time, you lack sound insight. Therefore, their coming into being you cannot unmistakably survey. Recall when last we met within the castle of that spirit order. You spoke to me with words of flattery, intending to unloose my deepest self-conceit. Remembrance of this time bestows on me the strength to make a stand against you. Ahriman withdraws with a reluctant gesture. Thunder. Maria continues. Defeated, he has had to leave this place which Benedictus has so often blessed. But gloriously he has revealed to me how quickly error can take hold of souls when they incautiously expose themselves to spirit hearing and avoid the safer paths. The adversary has indeed the power to play upon life's contradictions, and thus to rob men's souls of certainty. He must fall silent when the light appears which radiates from wisdom's innate sources and grants full clarity to spirit sight. The curtain falls, with Maria remaining in the room. The end of scene 11. Now scene 12. The same room as in scene 11. Johannes and Lucifer. Lucifer. Perceive within Capacius those fruits which ripen when a soul attempts too early to penetrate the spirit world. He now can read his book of life and knows his obligations for all coming lives. But suffering, which does not lie within the plan of destiny, arises out of knowledge that lacks power to shape itself to deeds in life. Whatever in a man leads to success depends upon the ripeness of his will. At every step that now he takes in life, Capacius must ask himself, do I fulfill with this an obligation which is the outgrowth of my former life? Thus falls on everything a light that dazzles painfully his eyes, but can in no way be of help to him. It deadens forces, which unconscious still are trusty guides for every human soul, and yet this light cannot enhance clear-minded thoughtfulness. Through it the body's mighty strength is lamed before the soul becomes the body's master. Johannes, I can perceive the error of my life, for I deprived my body of soul forces by carrying them proudly into spirit realms. A human being, incomplete, was thus led upward toward the light. It was a thin soul shadow only that was enraptured by the spirit worlds and felt as one with the creative powers. He wished to live in bliss within the light and to behold the deeds of light in colors. As artist, this soul shadow fancied he recreated spirit life in worlds of sense. This being who had borrowed all my features has shown me to myself in dreadful truth. I dreamed about the purest love of soul, but passion raged through all my veins. And now I could behold that earthly path which truly has created all my life today. It shows me how to strive in honest truth. How can the ways of spirit I pursued be still continued by the soul that found itself before this earthly path within the body of the miner, Thomas? The way in which he shaped his life makes me aware of all my present tasks. In this life I have striven to attain what only later can bear fruit for me. Lucifer, my light must firmly lead you on, as until now you let yourself be led. The spirit path you have set foot upon unites the spirit with the higher world, but shrouds the soul in darkness. Johannes, what has a man achieved if he surrenders his soulless self unto the spirit world? The end of all his days on earth will find him the very being that he was when in primeval times his human form was born out of the cosmic womb. If I surrender to those urges which force their way with strength toward life's reality out of unconscious depths of soul, then the whole cosmos will be working in me. I do not know what drives me on to act, yet certainly the cosmic will itself will lead me on according to its plan. This cosmic will must know the goal of life through human though human knowledge cannot grasp it. What it creates in man's totality is wealth of life through which the soul takes shape. I will surrender to it and no longer suppress it by my worthless spirit striving. Lucifer, within this cosmic will I am at work, when it streams mightily through souls of men. They are but parts of higher entities, until they can experience my power. I am the first to make them truly men, whose inmost self they bring into accord with the whole universe. Johannes, for some time have I thought I know you well, and yet there only lived in me your shadow, projected into me by spirit vision. Now must I feel you through my will. Then I can overcome you later on, if so the planning of my destiny ordains it. Let spirit knowledge that I gained too soon repose henceforth within my inmost soul, till my own impulses of life awaken it. With confidence I now surrender to that will that is much wiser than the human soul. Exit Johannes with Lucifer. Curtain, end of scene 12. This is the last scene of the play.
the mystery drama, scene 13. The Sun Temple, the hidden mystery place of the Hierophants. Lucifer, Ahriman, the three soul figures, Strader, Benedictus, Theodosius, Romanus, Maria. Enter at first Lucifer and Ahriman. Lucifer, victorious, the Lord of all desire stands here before you. I have succeeded in the conquest of that soul, who even in the brightness of the spirit sun feels it's still related to our realm. At the right moment I could blind him to the vision of the shine of light, to which he only dreamingly had yielded. But all my hopes that we shall be victorious in the spirit realm must vanish when now I turn to you, my comrade in the battle. You could not conquer for yourself the one who would have brought our labor to its goal. I can maintain the human soul surrendered now to me within our realms for but brief spans of earthly time. Yet all in vain, for soon I must return him to our foes. To win full victory we'll need the second one, who has withdrawn from your control. Ahriman, the time is not propitious for my action. I find no means of access to men's souls. One is approaching whom I've stirred up tenaciously. Though he is coming, ignorant in spirit, the drive for reasoning compels him on. I must give way to him and to this place, where he can only come unconsciously. Exit Ahriman. The three soul forces enter with Strader. Philea. I will imbue myself with illumining power of faith. I will inspire myself with living force of trust from inner joy, of striving, that thus the spirit sleeper may be awakened by the light. Astrid. I will weave into one the treasured word of revelation and humble joy of soul. I will condense the shining rays of hope. They shall ray forth in darkness, and they shall dimly gleam in light, that thus the spirit sleeper may be upheld by powers of hope and joy. Luna. I will bring warmth to light of soul. I will make firm the force of love, that they take courage for themselves, that they redeem themselves, and rising high, endow themselves with weight, that thus the spirit sleeper may be released from cosmic burdens and liberated by inner joy of light. There appear Benedictus, Theodosius, and Romanus. Benedictus, my brothers, I have summoned you who are to me companions in search of spirit light, which shall stream forth to souls of men. You know the nature of the sun of soul. It radiates at times in midday's perfect brightness. At other times it weakly penetrates the mist of dreams in twilight's glimmer, and often it must yield to darknesses. The temple servant's spirit sight must penetrate those depths of soul where spirit light shines mightily from cosmic heights. However, it must also find those somber goals that wish to guide man's growing forces unconsciously in darknesses of soul. The spirit beings who bestow on cosmic souls the spirit nourishment from cosmic powers are present now within our hallowed temple. They wish to guide the aims of one man's soul from spirit night to lofty regions of the light. The sleep of knowledge still envelops him. But a summons of the spirit has already sounded in his unconscious depths of being. What they have spoken to his inmost soul will soon pierce through into his spirit hearing. Theodosius. His soul was not yet able to discover itself again within the light of spirit, which radiates through senses' revelation and shows the meaning of all earthly progress. He saw God's spirit unadorned by nature and saw all that belongs to nature God estranged. Through many earthly lives, he felt a stranger confronting the true meaning of existence and only found as tools of his own being those sheaths of body which severed him from world and from mankind. He will acquire forces in the temple
to feel the alien life outside him as his own, and so be able to attain the power which frees the soul from the labyrinths of thought and shows the pathway to the springs of life. Benedictus, another man is striving for the temple's light. In future only will he near its portals and ask for entrance to this hallowed place. Throughout a life of serious search for knowledge, he has implanted seeds of thinking in his soul. The spirit light shone on these seeds and ripened them outside the temple. He could perceive his present life on earth as sequence of another life he had experienced in times long past. He has become aware of errors in that life and realizes all their consequences. He lacks the power to fulfill the duties which he can sense through knowledge of his self. Romanus. Capesius shall, through powers of this temple, learn how a man must, in a single life, be burdened with the duties which demand to be absolved in their full measure only by many of his lives of earthly pilgrimage. And so he will acknowledge without fear that he must carry consequences of former errors still beyond the gate of death. He certainly will prove victorious in battles that lay open spirit portals when boldly he confronts the guardian who stands there at the threshold of the spirit land. This guardian will make manifest to him that no one reaches into heights of life who fears his book of destiny. With courage he will come to the conviction that self-enlightenment must come through pain. The will becomes companion to the one who bravely goes to meet what is to come, and fortified by hope's strength-giving stream, will boldly face the pain which knowledge brings. Benedictus, you have, my brothers, at this present hour, as faithful servants of our temple, marked out the paths in wisdom on which you'll lead both seekers for the spirit to goals that are essential to their souls. The service of this temple asks for further work. You see the Lord of all desire here at our side. This sacred place he was allowed to enter because Johannes' soul could open portals which otherwise are barred to him. Our brother, whom we've given consecration, lacks still the power to resist courageously the words arising out of darknesses. Good forces will grow strong in him when on their opposite they test themselves. Soon will he be received within our temple, encompassed by our warm fraternal love, and yet the treasure of his spirit must be guarded now that his will is to descend into dark realms. Benedictus, turning to Lucifer, I must address myself to you who not for long must rule the place where you are standing. The temple's power at present cannot wrest Johannes' soul from your domain, but in the future he'll be ours again, when those fruits of our sister's deeds that now as blossoms we can see will ripen. Maria appears. She was allowed to see in her past life on earth how closely linked Johannes was to her. He followed after her in those days, even when she herself tried to resist the light to which she now devotes herself. When bonds of love prove strong enough, they may outlast the spirit's transformations. Then will the power of the Lord of all desire most certainly be shattered by their firmness. Lucifer. But it was Benedictus's will itself to separate Johannes from Maria. And where men separate from one another, the field is well prepared for my dominion. I'm ever searching for those souls who live completely for themselves, that I may liberate from cosmic servitude a life on earth for all eternity. Maria, in the clothing of a monk, could turn the soul away from his own father, the soul indwelling now Johannes's form. For me this too prepared the seeds which I can surely bring to ripening. Maria, turning to Lucifer. In human beings, there are springs of love to which your power cannot penetrate. They are unsealed when faults of former lives, which man has brought upon himself unconsciously, are seen with spirit eyes in later lives on earth, and by free will of sacrifice, are then transformed to deeds which fructify true human progress.
The powers of destiny have granted me the retrospect of former days on earth. The signs are also now revealed to me, by which I learn to guide my will to sacrifice, that good may come to those whose threads of life are interwoven with my own throughout the evolution of the earth. I saw Johannes's soul within its former body, withdrawing from his father, and saw the powers which compelled me to estrange the son from his own father's heart. Thus does the father now confront me, reminding of my ancient debt to him. He speaks distinctly in a cosmic language, whose symbols are the actions of man's life. What I have set between the son and father now reappears, though in another form, within this life, which bound again Johannes' soul so closely to my own. And in the pain I had to undergo in severing Johannes from myself, I can see destiny at work in my own deeds. If now my soul is loyal to the light which spirit powers bestow on it, it will be strengthened by the services which I may render to Capasius upon his arduous life pilgrimage. With forces one like this, my soul beholds Johannes's star with certainty. Although at times misled by fetters of desire, he does not walk the path illumined by the light. The spirit vision, which has led me back to distant days on earth, will teach me now how in the present I must shape those bonds of soul, so that life forces, once prepared unconsciously, may work in clarity for man's welfare. Benedictus. There formed itself in earlier days on earth a knot from threads that karma spun in world becoming. In it three human lives are interwoven. There shines forth on this knot of destiny the lofty spirit light within the temple. To you, Maria, I must address myself, for you alone of these three souls are present in this hour and at this holy place. May in yourself this light now heal and turn into the good those forces which once firmly bound your threads of life with all the others in a knot of destiny. In former days, the father could not find the heart of his own son, but now the spirit seeker will accompany your friend upon his path into the spirit land. Yours is the duty to maintain Johannes's soul within the light. When once you held him fast in bondage, he could but blindly follow you. You gave him back his liberty, which he still clung to, when he still clung to you, infatuated. You'll find him once again, when he succeeds in conquering his selfhood for himself. If your soul can be loyal to the light which spirit powers bestow on you, Johannes' soul will thirst for you in realms where still the Lord of all desire holds sway. And through the love which keeps it bound to you, his soul will find the path into the light. For he who knowingly beheld the heights of spirit from his depths of soul can pass through light and darkness livingly. From cosmic reaches he has breathed the air which quickens life to all eternity, and living raises every human life from depths of soul to lofty regions of the sun. Curtain, the end of the second mystery drama written through Rudolf Steiner, entitled The Soul's Probation.